But whither, Socrates, are you going? And what has this to do with the comparative eligibility of pleasure and wisdom? Socrates replies that before we can adjust their respective claims, we want to know the number and kinds of both of them. What are they? He is requested to answer the question himself, that he will, if he may be allowed to make one or two preliminary remarks. In the first place, he has a dreamy recollection of hearing that neither pleasure nor knowledge is the highest good, for the good should be perfect and sufficient. But is the life of pleasure perfect and sufficient when deprived of memory, consciousness, anticipation? Is not this the life of an oyster? Or is the life of mind sufficient if devoid of any particle of pleasure? Must not the union of the two be higher and more eligible than either separately? And is not the element which makes this mixed life eligible more akin to mind than to pleasure? Thus pleasure is rejected, and mind is rejected. And yet there may be a life of mind, not human but divine, which conquers still. But, if we are to pursue this argument further, we shall require some new weapons, and by this, I mean a new classification of existence. Z. There is a finite element of existence, and A. an infinite, and 3. the union of the two, and 4. the cause of the union. More may be added, if they are wanted, but at present we can do without them. And first of the infinite or indefinite, that is the class which is denoted by the terms more or less, and is always in a state of comparison. All words or ideas to which the words gently, extremely, and other comparative expressions are applied, fall under this class. The infinite would be no longer infinite, if limited or reduced to measure by number and quantity. The opposite class is the limited or finite, and includes all things which have number and quantity. And there is a third class of generation into essence by the union of the finite and infinite, in which the finite gives law to the infinite. Under this are comprehended health, strength, temperate seasons, harmony, beauty, and the like. The goddess of beauty saw the universal wantonness of all things, and gave law and order to be the salvation of the soul. But no effect can be generated without a cause, and therefore there must be a fourth class, which is the cause of generation, for the cause or agent is not the same as the patient or effect. And now, having obtained our classes, we may determine in which our conqueror life is to be placed, clearly in the third or mixed class, in which the finite gives law to the infinite, and in which is pleasure to find a place, as clearly in the infinite or indefinite, which alone, as Protarchus thinks, who seems to confuse the infinite with the superlative, gives to pleasure the character of the absolute good. Yes, retorts Socrates, and also to pain the character of absolute evil. And therefore the infinite cannot be that which imparts to pleasure the nature of the good. But where shall we place mind? That is a very serious and awful question, which may be prefaced by another. Is mind or chance the lord of the universe? All philosophers will say the first, and yet, perhaps, they may be only magnifying themselves. And for this reason I should like to consider the matter a little more deeply. Even though some lovers of disorder in the world should ridicule my attempt. Now the elements earth, air, fire, water, exist in us, and they exist in the cosmos. But they are purer and fairer in the cosmos than they are in us, and they come to us from thence. And as we have a soul as well as a body, in like manner the elements of the finite, the infinite, the union of the two, and the cause, are found to exist in us. And if they, like the elements, exist in us, and the three first exist in the world, must not the fourth or cause, which is the noblest of them, exist in the world? And this cause is wisdom or mind, the royal mind of Zeus, who is the king of all, as there are other gods who have other noble attributes. Observe how well this agrees with the testimony of men of old, who affirmed mind to be the ruler of the universe. And remember that mind belongs to the class which we term the cause, and pleasure to the infinite or indefinite class. We will examine the place and origin of both. What is the origin of pleasure? Her natural seat is the mixed class, in which health and harmony were placed. Pain is the violation, and pleasure the restoration of limit. There is a natural union of finite and infinite, which in hunger, thirst, heat, cold, is impaired. This is painful, but the return to nature, in which the elements are restored to their normal proportions, is pleasant. Here is our first class of pleasures. And another class of pleasures and pains are hopes and fears. These are in the mind only. And inasmuch as the pleasures are unalloyed by pains and the pains by pleasures, the examination of them may show us whether all pleasure is to be desired, or whether this entire desirableness is not rather the attribute of another class. But if pleasures and pains consist in the violation and restoration of limit, may there not be a neutral state, in which there is neither dissolution nor restoration? That is a further question, and admitting, as we must, the possibility of such a state, there seems to be no reason why the life of wisdom should not exist in this neutral state, which is, moreover, the state of the gods, who cannot, without indecency, be supposed to feel either joy or sorrow. The second class of pleasures involves memory. There are affections which are extinguished before they reach the soul, and of these there is no consciousness, and therefore no memory. And there are affections which the body and soul feel together, and this feeling is termed consciousness. And memory is the preservation of consciousness, and reminiscence is the recovery of consciousness. Now the memory of pleasure, when a man is in pain, is the memory of the opposite of his actual bodily state, and is therefore not in the body, but in the mind. And there may be an intermediate state, in which a person is balanced between pleasure and pain. In his body there is want which is a cause of pain, but in its mind a sure hope of replenishment, which is pleasant. But if the hope be converted into despair, he has two pains, and not a balance of pain and pleasure. Another question is raised: may not pleasures, like opinions, be a true and false? In the sense of being real, both must be admitted to be true, nor can we deny that to both of them qualities may be attributed, for pleasures as well as opinions may be described as good or bad. And though we do not all of us allow that there are true and false pleasures, we all acknowledge that there are some pleasures associated with right opinion, and others with falsehood and ignorance. Let us endeavor to analyze the nature of this association. Opinion is based on perception, which may be correct or mistaken. You may see a figure at a distance, and say first of all, "This is a man," and then say, "No, this is an image made by the shepherds." And you may affirm this in a proposition to your companion, or make the remark mentally to yourself. Whether the words are actually spoken or not, on such occasions there is a scribe within who registers them, and a painter who paints the images of the things which the scribe has written down in the soul. At least that is my own notion of the process. And the words and images which are inscribed by them may be either true or false, and they may represent either past, present, or future. And, representing the future, they must also represent the pleasures and pains of anticipation, the visions of gold and other fancies which are never wanting in the mind of man. Now these hopes, as they are termed, are propositions, which are sometimes true, and sometimes false. For the good, who are the friends of the gods, see true pictures of the future, and the bad false ones. And as there may be opinion about things which are not, were not, and will not be, which is opinion still, so there may be pleasure about things which are not, were not, and will not be, which is pleasure still, that is to say, false pleasure. And only when false, can pleasure, like opinion, be vicious. Against this conclusion Protarchus reclaims. Leaving his denial for the present, Socrates proceeds to show that some pleasures are false from another point of view. In desire, as we admitted, the body is divided from the soul, and hence pleasures and pains are often simultaneous. And we further admitted that both of them belong to the infinite class. How, then, can we compare them? Are we not liable, or rather certain, as in the case of sight, to be deceived by distance and relation? In this case the pleasures and pains are not false, because based upon false opinion, but are themselves false. And there is another illusion, Pain has often been said by us to arise out of the derangement, pleasure out of the restoration, of our nature. But in passing from one to the other, do we not experience neutral states, which although they appear pleasurable or painful are really neither? For even if we admit, with the wise man whom Protarchus loves, and only a wise man could have ever entertained such a notion, that all things are in a perpetual flux, still these changes are often unconscious, and devoid either of pleasure or pain. We assume, then, that there are three states, pleasurable, painful, neutral. We may embellish a little by calling them gold, silver, and that which is neither. But there are certain natural philosophers who will not admit a third state. Their instinctive dislike to pleasure leads them to affirm that pleasure is only the absence of pain. They are noble fellows, and, although we do not agree with them, we may use them as diviners who will indicate to us the right track. They will say that the nature of anything is best known from the examination of extreme cases, e.g. the nature of hardness from the examination of the hardest things, and that the nature of pleasure will be best understood from an examination of the most intense pleasures. Now these are the pleasures of the body, not of the mind, the pleasures of disease, and not of health, the pleasures of the intemperate, and not of the temperate. I am speaking, not of the frequency or continuance, but only of the intensity of such pleasures, and this is given them by contrast with the pain, or sickness of body which precedes them. Their morbid nature is illustrated by the lesser instances of itching and scratching, respecting which I swear, that I cannot tell, whether they are a pleasure or a pain. 1. Some of these arise out of a transition from one state of the body to another, as from cold to hot. 2. Others are caused by the contrast of an internal pain, and an external pleasure in the body. Sometimes the feeling of pain predominates, as in itching and tingling, when they are relieved by scratching. Sometimes the feeling of pleasure, or the pleasure which they give, may be quite overpowering, and is then accompanied by all sorts of unutterable feelings which have a depth of delights in them. But there are also mixed pleasures which are in the mind only. For are not love, and sorrow as well as anger sweeter than honey, and also full of pain? Is there not a mixture of feelings in the spectator of tragedy, and of comedy also? I do not understand that last. Well, then, with the view of lighting up the obscurity of these mixed feelings, let me ask, whether envy is painful? Yes. And yet the envious man finds something pleasing in the misfortunes of others. True. And ignorance is a misfortune? Certainly. And one form of ignorance is self-conceit. A man may fancy himself richer, fairer, better, wiser than he is. Yes. And he who thus deceives himself may be strong or weak. He may. And if he is strong we fear him. And if he is weak we laugh at him, which is a pleasure, and yet we envy him, which is a pain. These mixed feelings are the rationale of tragedy and comedy, and equally the rationale of the greater drama of human life. Having shown how sorrow, anger, envy are feelings of a mixed nature, I will reserve the consideration of the remainder for another occasion. Next follow the unmixed pleasures, which, unlike the philosophers of whom I was speaking, I believe to be real. These unmixed pleasures are, 1. The pleasures derived from beauty of form, color, sound, smell, which are absolutely pure, and in general those which are unalloyed with pain. 2. The pleasures derived from the acquisition of knowledge, which in themselves are pure, but may be attended by an accidental pain of forgetting. This, however, arises from a subsequent act of reflection, of which we need take no account. At the same time, we admit that the latter pleasures are the property of a very few. To these pure and unmixed pleasures we ascribe measure, whereas all others belong to the class of the infinite, and are liable to every species of excess. And here several questions arise for consideration. What is the meaning of pure and impure, of moderate and immoderate? We may answer the question by an illustration. Purity of white paint consists in the clearness or quality of the white, and this is distinct from the quantity or amount of white paint. A little pure white is fairer than a great deal which is impure. But there is another question. Pleasure is affirmed by ingenious philosophers to be a generation. They say that there are two natures, one self-existent, the other dependent, the one noble and majestic, the other failing in both these qualities. I do not understand. There are lovers and there are loves.
Yes, I know, but what is the application?
The argument is in play, and desires to intimate that there are relatives and there are absolutes, and that the relative is for the sake of the absolute, and generation is for the sake of essence. Under relatives I class all things done with a view to generation, and essence is of the class of good. But if essence is of the class of good, generation must be of some other class, and our friends, who affirm that pleasure is a generation, would laugh at the notion that pleasure is a good, and at that other notion, that pleasure is produced by generation, which is only the alternative of destruction. Who would prefer such an alternation to the equable life of pure thought? Here is one absurdity, and not the only one, to which the friends of pleasure are reduced. For is there not also an absurdity in affirming that good is of the soul only, or in declaring that the best of men, if he be in pain, is bad? And now, from the consideration of pleasure, we pass to that of knowledge. Let us reflect that there are two kinds of knowledge, the one creative or productive, and the other educational and philosophical. Of the creative arts, there is one part purer, or more akin to knowledge than the other. There is an element of guesswork, and an element of number and measure in them. In music, for example, especially in flute playing, the conjectural element prevails, while in carpentering there is more application of rule and measure. Of the creative arts, then, we may make two classes, the less exact, and the more exact. And the exacter part of all of them is really arithmetic and mensuration. But arithmetic and mensuration again may be subdivided with reference either to their use in the concrete, or to their nature in the abstract, as they are regarded popularly in building and binding, or theoretically by philosophers. And, borrowing the analogy of pleasure, we may say that the philosophical use of them is purer than the other. Thus we have two arts of arithmetic, and two of mensuration. And truest of all in the estimation of every rational man is dialectic, or the science of being, which will forget and disown us, if we forget and disown her. But, Socrates, I have heard Gorgias say that rhetoric is the greatest and usefulest of arts, and I should not like to quarrel either with him or you. Neither is there any inconsistency, Protarchus, with his statement in what I am now saying. For I am not maintaining that dialectic is the greatest or usefulest, but only that she is the truest of arts. My remark is not quantitative but qualitative, and refers not to the advantage or reputation of either, but to the degree of truth which they attain. Here Gorgias will not care to compete. This is what we affirm to be possessed in the highest degree by dialectic. And do not let us appeal to Gorgias or Philebus or Socrates, but ask, on behalf of the argument, what are the highest truths which the soul has the power of attaining? And is not this the science which has a firmer grasp of them than any other? For the arts generally are only occupied with matters of opinion, and with the production and action and passion of this sensible world. But the highest truth is that which is eternal and unchangeable. And reason and wisdom are concerned with the eternal, and these are the very claimants, if not for the first, at least for the second place, whom I propose as rivals to pleasure. And now, having the materials, we may proceed to mix them, first recapitulating the question at issue. Philebus affirmed pleasure to be the good, and assumed them to be one nature. I affirmed that they were two natures, and declared that knowledge was more akin to the good than pleasure. Said that the two together were more eligible than either taken singly, and to this we adhere. Reason intimates, as at first, that we should seek the good, not in the unmixed life, but in the mixed. The cup is ready, waiting to be mingled, and here are two fountains, one of honey, the other of pure water, out of which to make the fairest possible mixture. There are pure and impure pleasures, pure and impure sciences. Let us consider the sections of each which have the most of purity and truth,
To admit them all indiscriminately would be dangerous. First we will take the pure sciences, but shall we mingle the impure, the art which uses the false rule and the false measure? That we must, if we are any of us to find our way home, men cannot live upon pure mathematics alone. And must I include music, which is admitted to be guesswork?
Yes, you must, if human life is to have any humanity.
Well, then, I will open the door, and let them all in. They shall mingle in an Homeric meeting of the waters. And now we turn to the pleasures. Shall I admit them?
Admit first of all the pure pleasures. Secondly, the necessary.
And what shall we say about the rest?
First, ask the pleasures. They will be too happy to dwell with wisdom.
Secondly, ask the arts and sciences. They reply that the excesses of intemperance are the ruin of them, and that they would rather only have the pleasures of health and temperance, which are the handmaidens of virtue.
But still we want truth.
That is now added, and so the argument is complete, and may be compared to an incorporeal law, which is to hold fair all over a living body. And now we are at the vestibule of the good, in which there are three chief elements, truth, symmetry, and beauty. These will be the criterion of the comparative claims of pleasure and wisdom. Which has the greater share of truth?
Surely wisdom, for pleasure is the veriest imposture in the world, and the perjuries of lovers have passed into a proverb.
Which of symmetry?
Wisdom again, for nothing is more immoderate than pleasure.
Which of beauty?
Once more, wisdom, for pleasure is often unseemly, and the greatest pleasures are put out of sight.
Not pleasure, then, ranks first in the scale of good, but measure, and eternal harmony.
Second comes the symmetrical, and beautiful and perfect.
Third, mind and wisdom.
Fourth, sciences and arts and true opinions.
Fifth, painless pleasures.
Of a sixth class, I have no more to say.
Thus, pleasure and mind may both renounce the claim to the first place. But mind is 10,000 times nearer to the chief good than pleasure.
Pleasure ranks fifth and not first, even though all the animals in the world assert the contrary.
From the days of Aristippus and Epicurus to our own times, the nature of pleasure has occupied the attention of philosophers.
Is pleasure an evil, a good, the only good, are the simple forms which the inquiry assumed among the Socratic schools.
But at an early stage of the controversy another question was asked. Do pleasures differ in kind, and are some bad, some good, and some neither bad nor good?
There are bodily, and there are mental pleasures, which were at first confused but afterwards distinguished.
A distinction was also made between necessary and unnecessary pleasures, and again between pleasures which had or had not corresponding pains. The ancient philosophers were fond of asking, in the language of their age, is pleasure a becoming only, and therefore transient and relative, or do some pleasures partake of truth and being?
To these ancient speculations the moderns have added a further question, whose pleasure?
The pleasure of yourself, or of your neighbor, of the individual, or of the world?
This little addition has changed the whole aspect of the discussion.
The same word is now supposed to include two principles as widely different as benevolence and self-love.
Some modern writers have also distinguished between pleasure the test, and pleasure the motive of actions.
For the universal test of right actions, how I know them, may not always be the highest, or best motive of them, why I do them.
Socrates, as we learn from the Memorabilia of Xenophon, first drew attention to the consequences of actions.
Mankind were said by him to act rightly, when they knew what they were doing, or, in the language of the Gorgias, did what they would.
He seems to have been the first who maintained that the good was the useful.
In his eagerness for generalization, seeking, as Aristotle says, for the universal in ethics, he took the most obvious intellectual aspect of human action which occurred to him.
He meant to emphasize, not pleasure, but the calculation of pleasure.
Neither is he arguing that pleasure is the chief good, but that we should have a principle of choice.
He did not intend to oppose the useful to some higher conception, such as the Platonic ideal, but to chance and caprice. The Platonic Socrates pursues the same vein of thought in the Protagoras, where he argues against the so-called sophist that pleasure and pain are the final standards and motives of good and evil, and that the salvation of human life depends upon right estimate of pleasures greater or less when seen near and at a distance. The testimony of Xenophon is thus confirmed by that of Plato, and we are therefore justified in calling Socrates the first utilitarian, as indeed there is no side or aspect of philosophy which may not with reason be ascribed to him. He is Cynician, Cyrenaic, Platonist, and Aristotelian in one. But in the Phaedo the Socratic has already passed into a more ideal point of view, and he, or rather Plato speaking in his person, expressly repudiates the notion that the exchange of less pleasure for a greater can be an exchange of virtue. Such virtue is the virtue of ordinary men who live in the world of appearance. They are temperate, only that they may enjoy the pleasures of intemperance, and courageous from fear of danger. Whereas the philosopher is seeking after wisdom, and not after pleasure, whether near or distant. He is the mystic, the initiated, who has learned to despise the body, and is yearning all his life long for a truth which will hereafter be revealed to him. In the Republic the pleasures of knowledge are affirmed to be superior to other pleasures, because the philosopher so estimates them, and he alone has had experience of both kinds. Compare a similar argument urged by one of the latest defenders of utilitarianism, Mill's utilitarianism. In the Philebus, Plato, although he regards the enemies of pleasure with complacency, still further modifies the transcendentalism of the Phaedo. For he is compelled to confess, rather reluctantly, perhaps, that some pleasures, i.e. those which have no antecedent pains, claim a place in the scale of goods.